From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, how do you preserve the internet with websites changing daily, even hourly? Well, that's what Brewster Kahle has been doing for years. The San Francisco computer scientist and inventor is the founder of the Internet Archive, a library of the internet. And as part of our first-person series on leaders and innovators who shape the Bay Area, Brewster Kahle joins us in studio to talk about his goal of universal access to all knowledge. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. There's a library of the internet, and it's run by Brewster Kahle. The San Francisco computer scientist, inventor, philanthropist, is the founder of the Internet Archive and inventor of the Wayback Machine that preserves not just web pages, but books, music, and movies in pursuit of providing universal access to all knowledge. And it's not just information accessibility that Kahle's after. He's also experimenting with ways to make housing more accessible. Brewster Kahle joins us as part of our first-person series, which highlights the leaders and innovators who make the Bay Area unique. Thanks so much for being here and welcome to Forum.
Great to be here.
So the Internet Archive is a digital library, and you describe yourself as a digital librarian. How is it different from, you know, the effort to copy books, films, music, and store those onto hard drives?
The idea is to build the Library of Alexandria version 2. Can we actually make all the published works of humankind available to anybody curious enough to want to have access? Can we actually make it so that all the books, music, video, web pages, software that we've all that people have published ever since cuneiform, can we make it so that you can just go online, click, and be able to see, read, experience, and then add to the library again, and then have that be permanent? Can we do that? And the answer is yes.
And I want to ask you about how you're doing that. And in particular, if I could start with how you archive web pages. I mean, they're constantly overwritten. They're always changing. Links break all the time. I mean, what's the average life of a web page?
The average life of a web page is about 100 days before it's either changed or deleted. And so we started in 1996 by just trying to take a snapshot of all the pages. It's kind of like going to every page and then clicking every link and saving the page that comes back and just go, 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 and then start again after 2 months and then do it again and again and again. And it's starting to get big.
Yeah. I mean, so every 2 months you have sort of these crawlers, I guess, go
yes.
And I've heard
yes.
That, but that's the term to describe them. Go and just sort of snap.
Yes, it's actually now it's gotten to be much more interesting and complicated. We now have these crawlers that sort of just try to take a snapshot every 2 months. But we now have 1,000 librarians around the world are trying to build subject collections to make sure that we really get it. So there's actually, I know we've gotten a shooting this morning, but there are librarians now going and taking, making sure we have all of the links and all of the comments around that particular shooting to make sure that it's archived well. So there are librarians going and making sure we've archived everything in a fantastic way. So we have a historical record of what's basically a fleeting media.
So then how do you choose what subjects that these 1,000 or so librarians will be focusing on?
It's up to them. It's actually there are 350 institutions that contract with the Internet Archive, subscribe to go and build these collections, and then they get put together to be the Wayback Machine. But you can go and do subject-oriented collections as well. We do this for the Library of Congress. And their librarians figure out what it is that should be archived. Every 2 years, we do all the congressional websites for the National Archives. We work with national libraries. Anyway, it's become a big project to figure out how to archive it. Then how do you make it available again in such a way that people can use it? We made the Wayback Machine, named after the Rocky and Bullwinkle show.
Uh-huh, I was wondering
Wayback
that
Machine. You know, it's a dial its time
name.
Back, and you can go back to the web the way it was. And then type in a URL. On archive.org. See, it's free. You can go and type in a URL and see the past versions and click around at the web as it was.
Wow. It sort of goes against this whole notion that we think once we put something on the web, the fact that everything changes, initially you worry that, you know, everything that you put on there will be there forever, even the good, the bad, the ugly about
right.
yourself, right? And then in talking with you and about sort of the way that web pages change every 100 days and you can snap a snapshot of them every couple months, you realize sort of the volatility of these pages. But now you are trying to archive and keep, you know, permanent something that is fleeting in this way. So I guess one of the questions that I have for you then is, how are you able to store all of this information and how are people able to search it? I mean, it must be just massive at this point.
It's just massive. And so you have to keep focused on the basic problem. Oh, but to your problem, some things aren't meant for the ages. Some people actually don't want their pages in the Wayback Machine. So they either can put a robot exclusion on their website or they write to us at archive.org and we just take them down.
Oh, really?
And so, yeah. So there's, you know, the web has got things that should be permanent. And then there are people's blogs when they were married to somebody else and they just don't want it around anymore. And so it's up to them to take it down. The way we store this is actually on lots and lots of computers that actually live in a former church in the Richmond district in San Francisco. So there it's petabytes of data.
Petabytes.
Yeah. It goes kilobytes. Then megabytes, gigabytes, terabytes. And what comes after tera is peta. And we have over 20 petabytes of data now. We collect, I don't know, a petabyte a month, something like that, almost. And the idea is to store that permanently. So you don't want to just have one copy in San Francisco. So we have another copy in Richmond or in Redwood City. And we have a partial copy in Amsterdam and a partial copy in Alexandria, Egypt. The idea is that what happens to libraries is, well, they're burned.
I was going to say, what if somebody, destroyed the library?
Yeah, if we're going to try to build the Library of Alexandria version 2, let's learn from the Library
right,
of Alexandria
that it burned.
Version
right.
1. It's like, well, it's not here anymore.
Right.
What if they had just made another copy and put a copy into India or China? We'd have the other works of Aristotle, the other plays of Euripides. But we don't. So the idea is, like, we're going to do this again. Let's learn from it. So we're trying to figure out how to go and have exchanges with different cultural environments. What happens to libraries is they're burned, and they're generally burned by governments, actually. The new guys don't want the old stuff around. Sometimes it's accidental, but mostly it's, you know, they just don't want it around. They're sorry about it 100 years later, but if that's the only copy, then it's gone, gone, gone. So the idea is to have multiple copies, which in the digital world you can actually do, in multiple places in such a way that there's an exchange agreement between these different cultural areas.
We're talking with Brewster Kahle, internet pioneer, scientist, inventor, who's on a mission to preserve the internet and ensure universal access to all knowledge. So, as you said, there exists the library in a physical space in the Richmond on Funston, right?
Yes.
And so if somebody were to go visit it, what would they see? What could they do there at the Internet Archive?
Well, we have tours every Friday at 1 o'clock. People are invited. And we tour around and you can see the people working. There are about 50 people there. But there are another 100 people that are working in scanning centers digitizing books all over the world. But the actual physical machines are there in the great room, the big room with the where the services used to be held, and the machines would be blinking away.
Because it used to be a church, that building.
It used to be a church. And one thing I love about these machines is when we designed it, there are little lights that blink. And it indicates every time a light blinks is somebody either uploading something or downloading something from the Internet Archive. There are about 2 to 3 million users that use the Internet Archive every day. It's about the 250th most popular website. Which 250, I mean, there are a lot of websites out there. We know. We collect them all. But they're 200, we're the top 250. So people want old stuff. They want the old books, Grateful Dead. They want the old web pages that we collect. And that's, I find, very encouraging that, people aren't just waiting for the next Lady Gaga CD to come out.
And because they exist as these sort of towers of blinking lights in your space, you will eventually outgrow the space, I imagine.
Actually, we will outgrow, and we've outgrown our last place when we were in the Presidio, but the hard drives keep getting more and more dense.
Mm-hmm.
As that keeps going, we're actually in relatively good stead. But it's starting to take warehouses to go and have the actual machines that serve these materials.
So in terms of search function, I had read that it's a little complicated.
Yes.
It's not the same as like a
search engine.
Yeah. So could you talk a little bit about how folks can search through these vast petabytes.
Right. Well, if you're talking about the web collection, then you actually have to remember the URL, right? The web address. So you can't start just by typing keywords or your name or something like that, which we'd love to do, but you have to type the URL. Actually, we just got a grant, which we're really excited about, that will allow us to search to be able to find the site. We may not be able to find the page because there are 450 billion pages in this collection. It is enormous, and it's growing a billion pages every week. So we don't know how to build a search engine that's that big. That's larger than Google's collection, I understand. So the idea is you can surf the web by remembering URL and then clicking around. So it's basically surf the web as it was.
Do you keep data on what is the most searched thing, not so much, not just on web pages, but also what is the most commonly downloaded thing? Or
yes, and it's all over the chart. People like all sorts of weird. That's one of the I find encouraging is people are very particular and very peculiar. That they only want what they want. And what they want is a very wide variety. So we went and digitized all educational and industrial films, which, you know, I don't know. We saw those in school. And we digitized these from the Prelinger archives. And it turns out they're wildly popular. People like this stuff from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s that are really was meant for a different generation at a different time. It gives a different impression of what's going on. We're digitizing home movies. And making those available.
Home movies.
Home movies. And people are uploading these sorts of things. We digitize 1,000 books every day from about 500 libraries have been making their books available. And so we've been making these available. And people plow around and experience all sorts of different kinds of things, whether it's old carpentry books or how to do knitting or old cooking books. There's even modern books. If you go to openlibrary.org, which is another one of our websites, you can actually borrow modern books, one reader at a time. So there's only one reader of these modern books that might have copyright issues. And this is a way of working with – oh, and television. We've been recording television since the year 2000.
Wow.
Russian, Chinese, Japanese, Iraqi, Al Jazeera, BBC, CNN, ABC, Fox, 24 hours a day, DVD quality. We're recording 60 channels now at DVD quality from 25 different countries. And we've made it so that you can search the U.S. television news for keywords based on what people said. So it's kind of – we want everyone to be a John Stewart research department, right? We want everybody to be able to find what was mentioned on television and quote it in their blogs. If you want the whole program, then we print it onto a DVD. And we send it to the patron, and then they have to return it, just like a library.
Well, do you run into copyright issues, though? I mean, downloading all those television programs, you know, and you're doing this from other countries, so, and I imagine they might have different rules.
The key thing is to make it so that people don't feel like they're being taken advantage of. Right? Libraries have copyrighted materials on their shelves. That's what we do, right? We buy things, we put them on the shelves, and we lend them out. That's what libraries are. And in the digital world, we're just doing the same. And we're basically trying to work with the publishers and the like to just make sure that we don't run into their business models, right? Everybody's trying to figure out how to make money in this internet. But the works are worth it. They're just wonderful to be able to go back and see all of these, well, television programs or old movies, these books. Otherwise, in the digital world, they just wouldn't be available at all.
But you have run up against resistance. As you said, you if they type in, you know, a particular
website. Yes. If people have a website that they don't want to be in the Wayback Machine and it's their website, not just somebody that they don't like or something like that, then we'll take it out of the Wayback Machine.
So you'll honor that.
Yes. We have sort of a bend, not break approach. Right?
Even though you're so committed to universal access to all knowledge.
Yes.
You know you won't be able to get all of it.
We're going to do as much as we can. And when we now have 2.5 million books, we've got 2 million movies, we have everything the Grateful Dead, every concert they've ever done, plus about 6,000 other bands, their concert recordings that are contributed by these different tapers. And software, all the PC, old PC and Apple II software. So the idea is to have that available as long as it's not being sold.
A listener asks, has the archive had to grapple yet with the European Union's right to be forgotten? So, you know, you mentioned that you comply with requests to take things down. But I'm just curious, have you had to deal with?
No, not really. Basically, because we've been kind of doing it all along. And the Wayback Machine is different from a search engine. I think the real problem is when people look their name up in Google and find things that they don't want to have up there and they want to be taken off. That's, I think, where most of that's coming from. And since you can't do that with the Wayback Machine, it doesn't come up as often.
Brewster Kahle is founder of the Internet Archive in San Francisco and inventor of the Wayback Machine. He spent decades preserving information, and he's trying to make it accessible to everyone. If you have a question for Brewster Kahle, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum at kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And Brewster Kahle, okay, so you've been getting at how delightful it is to see all these people getting involved, using the Wayback Machine, accessing all this great stuff that you've scanned. And why? Why is it so important? I know we've been sort of dancing around this, but why is it so important to you that everything is universally accessible?
Mina, it's actually I guess it's just an analogy with having seen things work in the print world, that libraries were really important then. And when we knew that this digital wave was coming. But then the question is, what can we do about this digital wave to take advantage of the capabilities and also to get around some of the faults? I mean, these hard drives just don't last very long. Just trying to get out your old emails or, you know, your family photos, if they're in the shoebox underneath your bed, then, hey, those will probably be around in 10, 20 years if you don't have a fire. But how about on your hard drive? Or how about if you put it on one of those commercial services that don't exist anymore? GeoCities or MobileMe by Apple. They just decided to just take it down and make it go away. So I'm an old school idealist and a technologist, and we're trying to figure out, what can we do that would actually be good with our technology? And so that set me on this path. And that was back in 1980, and I thought it would be a lot easier to finish than it has been. But it's been a long, long path. We don't have everything online. We were successful at getting people to turn to their computers and dealing with it as if it were the library, that you'd ask questions of it and you'd read these amazing things. And it's as if it's not online, it doesn't exist. But any of us that know something deeply know that it's not all there. And our job is to put the best we have to offer within reach of our children. And right now, it's not there. So we have to go and put everything that's really worth carrying forward online. So I find it's actually very motivating and very, energizing to say, every year that goes by that we don't have the 20th century books online, or things just are fading away from online existence, is another year that kids are being brought up with not the best we have to offer. We have an urgency to move forward.
And you touched on this concern about sort of a dystopian future where digitized information is centralized and owned by a few people or corporations or something along those lines.
And it's not just corporations. Yeah, I think just one is the wrong answer. You don't want just one copy. The Google Books project was an awesome project, got everybody motivated.
Yeah.
But it got actually ruled down by the judge by being a monopoly. And I think it was true. And even there are nonprofits that are setting up databases where they're the only ones that have old journal literature, and new young researchers such as Aaron Schwartz were trying to download too many, and they were arrested and then prosecuted for going and doing modern computer research. I don't think we just want one copy of these materials. We want lots of libraries, quirky, weird, interesting libraries, to flourish in this digital era.
So what drives this for you? I mean, what are the sort of origins of your commitment? Have you ever thought about what made you so committed to this idea of universal access to all knowledge? Any experiences?
It's actually walking across the Cambridge River in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when a friend of mine posed a question, which is, So you're an idealist? I said, yeah. And a technologist? Yeah. I said, paint a portrait that's better because of your technology. And, you know, this was back in the 1980s. And it was, we were really good about complaining about things. But it was hard to come up with a positive vision. And actually, it was, and I could only come up with two answers. One of them seemed too obvious, which was build the Library of Alexandria. So I tried to work on the other one, which is protect people's privacy. And I couldn't figure out back then how to do that well enough. So I went to plan B, which was build the library. And what's been fun about this career path is all the reinforcement over time. That if you're doing something that people want, people will just keep saying, gosh, thank you for doing that. And why don't you do more of this? Or have you thought about doing this too? And it's based on that encouragement that I've stayed on this path. And it's refined over time. The term universal access to all knowledge came from Raj Reddy from Carnegie Mellon. And I just cribbed it. And I said, can I just crib that as the motto of our organization in my life? And he said, yes, absolutely. Go for it. Most recently, there's somebody came up with the term locking the web open. Can we go and ensure that the web is permanently open? Can we bake the First Amendment into the code itself? Mm. And that's like, wow, that's a strong phrase. Can we just build that and run with it? And they said, yes, absolutely. Actually, I don't even remember who said it, but I don't think it was me. But anyway, now we've got a rallying flag of let's lock the web open. So it's based on that kind of encouragement over time. And it's been fun and interesting.
You've also said, though, that it's been longer and harder than you thought. What's been the hardest thing? What's been the most surprising challenge?
Institutions, institutional responsibility.
When
this big shift happened, getting I worked with the newspapers and getting them online during the early 90s to try to anchor the open world with Waze and Gopher and the World Wide Web. And they were actually willing to do it, and they moved forward. The music guys kicked and screamed, and that was kind of a pain, and they sued a lot of people, and that was a mistake, and they lost a decade. But the books guys, for instance, haven't really moved. But you think of the libraries, and they're just not really springing into it in the way that they could. This should be the librarian's day. The idea of taking our collections and making them available to people. But mostly they're just busy trying to deal with their physical collections, or they're just renting databases as opposed to building services themselves. I think we can do something much, much more.
And we'll continue our conversation with Brewster Kahle, internet pioneer and inventor who's on a mission to preserve the internet and to ensure universal access to all knowledge. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 866-733-6786. What are your thoughts on his goal? How do you feel about preserving the internet? You can also post your questions on our website at kqed.org/forum, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. You can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Brewster Kahle, internet pioneer, scientist, inventor, digital librarian, who's on a mission to preserve the internet. He's also the founder of the Internet Archive, the Wayback Machine, and he has spent decades preserving the information. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Ryan tweets, I always get a kick out of seeing my sites 10 years ago. Well, and being thankful that they look different now. Bruce writes, please ask Brewster about receiving a national security letter. Did you receive a national security letter, Brewster?
Yes, and I can actually talk about it. National security letters are these nasty part of the Patriot Act where almost anybody in law enforcement can go and demand information from almost anybody, and you can never say that it ever occurred. It has this gag order part of it.
Yes.
And so we got one of these from the FBI when they demanded information about a patron of the Internet Archive. And what do we do? Mm-hmm. I couldn't ask my board about what we do because I was under a gag. I couldn't even talk to my family. So I asked our lawyers, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is there any way to push back? Is there any court so that you can get it?
You're on the board of VFF, right?
I'm on the board of VFF. And they said, no, the only thing you can do is to sue the United States government. So we sued the United States government.
When was this?
And we won. It was a number of years ago now. 7 years ago. And that was the last time we ever got a national security letter, because they wanted out of that lawsuit immediately. And the I guess they didn't need the information all that much anyway. And so we got out of that. We didn't disclose patron information, because being rounded up for what it is you've read is a long and dreadful history in libraries. And so, and people understand that. And our being a library, even if it's a digital library, means that we win.
So you were able to sue. I mean, how do you fund your internet archive? I mean, that's not cheap, and okay, just generally in terms of.
Well, thankfully to the donors of the ACLU and EFF that took this case, all in secret. That was how it came about. Because interestingly, if I at the Internet Archive had started paying EFF, I would have had to explain it to our director of finance. And I wasn't allowed to. So all of this, but now the Internet Archive is...
Yeah, how does the Internet Archive itself get its funding?
It, like almost any library, except we're an independent from the government or the university. So we don't have, but we get funding to digitize books from libraries. So we digitize about 1,000 books every day for 10 cents a page. And that's about $5 million of our $12 million a year budget. About $2 million comes from libraries paying us to collect web pages for them. And then there's foundations and also end-of-year contributions from people all over the world that say thank you by giving us a contribution. So that's how, and by being actually really inexpensive in general, and depending on others. I mean, most of the work to build the Internet Archive is done by people out in the world going and uploading things. So we just have to kind of keep it all together and keep it moving. And most of the work is the communities out there on the Internet.
Let's go to some calls. Let's go to KO in Walnut Creek. Hi, KO.
Hi. Hi, Brewster. I wanted to thank you for the Temple of the Book, which was an installation in Berkeley of books that had been archived, and created a really wonderful opportunity for people to browse. I watched people browse and discover books that they've lost. And it was right in the middle of this time when a third of our county library collection had been disappeared, taxpayer investment, without any reason. And was this kind of purging, not way more than weeding, of a library collection something that you expected? The idea that we heard was that, well, it's all online now. A lot of our patrons don't
Thanks.
Have.
Yes. Oh, it was a great project. There was an idea of the Bay Area Book Festival, and it was in Berkeley, and it was built by Fluxus. And they had this idea of having a big book giveaway. Can we have a temple of books where you basically had all these books and you could just take them and bring them home? And we said, great, we've got 500,000 extra duplicate books, because we're not only collecting and digitizing books to be digital, we're collecting physical books now, because libraries are, as you say, okay, they're throwing them away. And so we are collecting one copy of every book ever published. We're up to around 1.5 million books in Richmond, California. We had to buy a second warehouse. So it's going great. But we have duplicates. And we don't like to throw away duplicates. And actually, we still have about 500,000. So if you have anybody, we really need them right now to come by with trucks to go and take away these duplicate books. But this book festival, they went, they had 60 volunteers finding really good books, and they built this temple. And people were amazed. They just saw these books and they said, you can take as many as you want. And the children's books went immediately, the reference books and histories. The ones that didn't go, interestingly, were the romances. They stayed on the shelves.
That is interesting. KO, thanks for the call. A listener asks, what relationship, if any, does the Internet Archive have with social media companies? Is the archive cataloging my Instagram posts? And what does Mr. Kale think about apps like Snapchat that appeal to people's desire for impermanence?
The Internet Archive only collects materials that have been made public in some way, so the web pages and the like, that don't have indications that we shouldn't collect them. And for instance, Facebook opts out completely. They just don't want anything archived by anybody else. Those are sort of these big organizations that kind of think of themselves as a world in and of themselves. They're not participating in the World Wide Web in the same sort of way. We're trying to do what we can with collecting public tweets, but that's actually hard because it's run by a company that sells that data, and we haven't been able to figure out how to work with them directly yet. Or Google, with their YouTube, we try to collect the popular YouTubes, the ones that have been linked to and tweeted about. So we try to get what's the public web, the public consciousness, but we only do things that are publicly available. So we don't do Snapchat, for instance, and the like.
Well, thanks for the question. Let's go to Evan in San Jose. Hi, Evan.
Yeah.
Yvonne, I'm sorry.
That's okay. My question revolves around security. Because he's being so forthright in telling us where they're located, if somebody has a problem, maybe you want to hide some information, you can blow up all the locations. My question is, does he have a hidden one that we, the public, don't know about? And two, cyberspace hacking. What are they doing about that? Huh. I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks.
Okay? Good questions. Our basic strategy is to go and have these materials preserved because they're loved. I mean, there's the bury it in the desert approach, which I wish we had the funding to be able to do that, but we don't. We're mostly trying to keep everything available. And where you hear about a lot of other organizations being constantly attacked and hacked, and we don't find that that's happening to us. Though we do have people that are on staff. We have one of the former experts in computer security from Yahoo, who does help us try to keep the data secure. So is it vulnerable? I guess it, in some sense, yes, I guess we're always somewhat insecure, but we're doing what we can to preserve things both here in the United States and having partial copies in other places.
How much of your budget is devoted to security?
Oh, minuscule. Minuscule. I mean, we're really about being open. I mean, if somebody wants to break into the library to read books, it seems like kind of a good deal to us. So we try to preserve the data. That's first and foremost. But trying to keep people out of certain things is like, well, we're pretty open. We don't even keep a lot of data that actually people would find scary. For instance, we don't keep IP addresses of our users. So if law enforcement comes and says, who's been reading this? We say, well, we don't know. We don't know. We live a fairly unexamined path because we really want to protect reader privacy.
Well, some of our listeners want you to get a little more specific here. Terry writes, please provide more info on how to get things. I'm on the site, openlibrary.org. Where are the DVD listings?
So there's two sites. There's openlibrary.org, which is really focused on books. And there's archive.org. That is about books, music, video, and all sorts of stuff. So if you're on openlibrary.org, the top row is books you can download and read because they're old enough to be public domain. The next row is where books you can borrow, and you try it out. Just go and try. You have to get a library card. It's free. And try borrowing a book, and you'll be the only one that's checked that book out until you either return it or 2 weeks go by. And you won't get dinged a nickel for not returning your book. But that's Open Library. Archive.org, if you go and type in a URL, maybe your old blog or your old college website, you can go and surf the web as it was in the Wayback Machine on archive.org.
Right.
If you go to the lower section, you can go for books, music, video. For music, you know, you might want to go and find a band, a concert recording from a band that you like. Or the movies from Prelinger is really popular. It's huge, and it is kind of hard to navigate. We're working on that, but we need your help.
Well, Connie asks, is there an index for all the old URLs?
The index for all the old URLs are the URLs, unfortunately, until we're able to go and make it so you can find a site based on just typing. So you can type in New York Times rather than remembering it's nytimes.com, which, you know, okay, New York Times is still alive. But if you take, you know, your old blog or somebody else's old blog, you may want to search them by name. So we'll help you get to the site, but not to the page. We don't know how to do page search yet. Those that are out there want to help and volunteer towards building these large-scale data systems. That's how this whole thing works.
Larry asks, can you watch the archives stuff on a Roku box?
The guys at Squeeze Box, which is sort of related to that, made it so that you could get to our concert recordings. I don't know if the Roku box made a plug-in for us. We don't have a lot of staff for doing these sort of different plug-ins that the commercial guys do, so it's often volunteers. So if you've got a Roku box, sometimes it's not that hard. Or how about I think Apple TV would be really fun to go and have be a way to get to a lot of our videos.
Nicole writes, I was wondering whether Brewster has expanded his collection of cylindrical vinyl and if those are being uploaded to the archive. Thank you for the awesome work you're doing.
Oh, I've been really getting into music. And so not just the Born Digital things on Bandcamp, SoundCloud, and concert recordings, but then CDs, which are really pretty gone. They're just, people don't sell them anywhere. I was in Istanbul and I wanted to go and buy a bunch of typical, and they said, oh no, we don't really do CDs anymore. And then there's LPs, which are making a resurgence, but they're still kind of dying more or less. Then I met some of the AV geeks that deal with 78 RPM records. And I went on eBay and bought some of these cylinder recordings, and Somebody gave me a cylinder player. And so I'm hoping that we can go all the way back to the old Edison cylinder recordings and bring all of this back online.
Wow. Well, let's go to more calls. Steve in Oakland. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing? Mainly also quickly wanted to give thanks for the Flex Foundations project, the Temple of the Book, is incredible. People can see that out there online, too, I think.
Thanks.
But mainly I just want to say, if there's anyone out there that is wondering, that hasn't seen this archive or they don't know what it is, taking, like, a night out, instead of going to your Netflix or trying to figure out what's on TV, to go to archive.org and just dig around, because I found it early on. And I'm a video guy, so I have some appreciation of that. But just it's a form of education and entertainment that you're not ever going to get from the movies, experiencing things as they truly were. And you get some incredible insights, you know, just searching your old hometown or, you know, the industry that your grandparents used to work in, and you get a whole new kind of take on things. So thanks for that.
Well, Steve, thanks. Thanks for the plug. And earlier I mentioned that in addition to trying to make information accessible to all, you're also trying to provide affordable housing or making housing more accessible to your employees. Can you talk a little bit about how you are doing that? Because I feel like what you're doing with the library really informs that effort.
Yes. Well, we're trying to build a sustainable organization that's non-governmental. And this isn't easy. I mean, if you don't get just money because you're a public library funded by the government or a university, you have to figure out how to make this go. And when the financial crisis happened, we polled our employees. We hired 150 people. It was part of a welfare to work program, the sort of shovel ready thing from the Obama administration. And we polled them, and as well as our professional, you know, programmers and stuff, and found, what are you spending money on and how is it going? And they said, it's going very poorly. We're spending 30 to 60% of our income on housing. 30 to 60%. 60%. It was incredible to me. And so we said, okay, how can we help? And we said, well, why is housing cost so much? In San Francisco, it's, of course, famously broken here, but it's because it's going up really fast and it's causing dislocations. But it turns out all across the country, it's 30 to 60%. And that's average.
Hmm.
So we said, why is it that high? And it turns out if you rent or even own your house, that 2/3 of the cost of your house is debt service. Debt service. So it's not the taxes. You know, people complain about taxes. It's not the taxes. It's not the maintenance. It's not the insurance. It's debt service. If you can make debt-free housing, then we can go and have 1/3 of market-based rent. This would work for us.
All right. So how do you make debt-free housing?
How do we make debt-free housing? Well, we thought, okay, we could transition housing by just taking a long-term view and paying off the mortgage and keeping it off. So we started a credit union to be able to help do that function. But that would take too long.
That's not easy.
That's not easy. And actually, it's turned out to be the regulators are really not interested in new credit unions coming around. They're basically in the business of shutting down credit unions. But that's a whole subject. They shut down 200 to 300 credit unions every year. They only let one or two start a year.
Really?
It is tragic. If you're in a credit union, you should just worry about when the regulators are going to come for yours. Anyway, it's not good.
So that's not.
But
the
anyway,
solution.
So mm-hmm. Well, that didn't work very well. So we just went and bought an apartment building to try this out, and so we now have several employees. The people that were in the apartment building are still there, but when they leave, then we offer it to nonprofit workers that are at the Internet Archive and a couple other nonprofits, so that they can have permanently affordable housing. But it's fixed to your employment. So when you leave your employment, you have to leave your house. So it's not as good as just having cheap housing. But it's if we can transition 5% of housing to be this kind of debt-free housing for nonprofit workers, I think we could build a whole housing class. We're calling it foundation housing. There's public housing. There's private housing. I think there's a room for foundation housing, which is permanently affordable, non-governmental housing that would support whoever basically starts the apartment building in that focus. Could be unions, it could be teachers, it could be hospital workers, it could be librarians. In our case, it's librarians. And so we're basically trying to build a model that could be replicated.
And you would fundraise for the—
We'd fundraise, but actually what's— I learned so much about this. It turns out that the cost of an apartment building is paid if you buy it. If you were to mortgage it at 100%, it's paid for by the renters. So if you think if you're renting, if you think you're paying for somebody else's mortgage, you're right. It's exactly what's going on.
Right.
So if we just buy it and use market-based renters to go and pay off the mortgage, then we can go and transition housing to be permanently debt-free. So we're using the ideas of open source software to put licenses, like Creative Commons licenses, to keep apartment buildings from getting new debt. I looked at the housing that was done 100 years ago in reaction to the tenements in New York, and those buildings were beautiful, but they're all full of bankers now. What happened to them? And they basically got sold off to the people that were in them, and it was a bonanza for them, and it was, you know, terrific, but it didn't help in an enduring way. Can we make housing, say 5% of housing all over the country, dedicated to nonprofit workers? I think this would be a fantastic way to put the country on good footing for the next century.
Brewster Kahle, founder of the Internet Archive, who wants to make information accessible to everyone and housing accessible to nonprofits. We are getting lots of questions. Let me go to Craig, who asks, I'm tired of paying full price to download an ebook to my iPad, only to find that all of the images, photos, maps, etc., have been redacted, replaced by a lame disclaimer that the publisher didn't secure digital rights to that content, or that the photos have been badly distorted in the scanning process. Does this project address that issue?
When we scan the books completely, and we think beautifully in color, and we try to do it just as well as possible. And when we lend books, we lend them actually sort of as is, so you can see them. But we're staying back into sort of the 20th century books because we're trying to buy books from publishers if they'll actually sell books the same way they used to sell books to libraries. But the publishers aren't doing it.
Oh.
They're going and selling books with these license agreements that basically make the books evaporate after a year or two. And that's not the way to make a system work. So we're trying to work. Libraries spend $3 or $4 billion a year on publishers' products. I'm not suggesting we spend any less. I just suggest we spend it better and that we go and buy books the way we used to buy books, where the libraries only could keep only a certain number in circulation. We're good at that. But then but we can keep them and format change them, even if the publisher goes away or the book goes out of print. That's what you really want libraries for as well. So we're trying to do a good job and trying to provide a model for libraries going forward to use the old models going forward rather than thinking, oh, let's just take all the images out of books. I mean, isn't that criminal? I mean, it's the worst thing. These books. I mean, I'm sure really mad. But I think we've gotten ourselves all wrapped up in a knot and we should just kind of breathe deeply and build libraries, build publishers that make sense. Don't lock down everything with random security DRM, the digital rights management software that really hurt the music industry for 10 years. What can we do to make books work the way they used to work? Love books.
So how do you stop all these obstacles from getting you down?
We're just moving through them slowly and publicly. And so this program, for instance, by just saying what it is we're doing and why, and it makes it so that people understand that we're not a threat and we're just moving through the processes. So bringing all the web pages online was a little nerve-wracking at the time. Starting to lend books by the hundreds of thousands, a little nerve-wracking at the time, but everybody seems to understand what it is we're trying to do. Now we've got this television lending program. It's going great. I have to figure out what to do with music and things like that still. But I'm encouraged just by, well, listeners like, you know, those that are calling in and just the pats on the back you get for life. That's, I don't know, it's what I live for.
You are asking, though, entities to really put a lot of faith in you.
It's not in me. It's in the library. It's going and saying, we've always wanted library systems. We've always funded library systems. It's $12 billion a year total cost in the United States, $3 or $4 billion to publishers' products. I just love going. I was in rural Vermont, and every town had a library. People love their libraries. And their libraries try to work with local authors. They're not about putting people out of business. They're about keeping things healthy and available and keeping the lifeblood of organizations. And so being a techie and a geek, right, that's where I'm from, MIT and all of that sort of thing. I think the library model is a really one that we should look at. I would like to see royalty payments to authors for book publishing again, rather than some of these license agreements where the authors get almost nothing.
Bruce asks, in the early 80s, I wrote numerous programs in Apple Basic, such as a tic-tac-toe game. They are on 5.5-inch floppy disks. Is this something you would archive?
Oh,
the disks are still readable.
Yes. There's this wonderful man, Jason Scott, that joined the archive a couple of years ago. And he's been going around working with the Apple II and Commodore 64 and the Atari communities that have been going and putting these materials onto hard drives. And then he worked with these different communities to make it so that you could go to archive.org, go to the software link, and actually boot an old Apple II and run that software. So we have tens of thousands of old computer programs, but we may not have yours. So we're trying to make it so that people can upload their old floppies, if you can read it, and get the bits off, upload it, and then run it there. But with emulators, we can actually keep all of that work. Just keep it moving.
Don't get rid of those, Bruce.
Don't get rid of it. And bring them forward. You know, just keep we have actually some 5.25-inch hard drives, and Jason Scott's the man for you.
Laura in Oakland. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I just had a comment. I read an article, Is Google Making Us Stupid? And the whole kind of point of the article is that in schools today, and I'm a student, we are kind of taught to skim things on the internet and just get the gist of it, and we're not really reading books anymore. We're just kind of skimming online. And what do you think of that, and how can we change that?
I have to say, given the choice, I still read paper books. I relate to them in a very different way. I'm like you. I skim. I think because part of the problem is the screens are still kind of nasty to look at. They're getting a lot better, so it's easier to sort of settle in. I read most of my news online, even long form magazine articles at this point. So there's sort of just presentation. But there's also this temptation to just click away, and there's always something else you can be doing right there, a click away. So sometimes maybe taking things offline is a way to go.
Laura, thanks for the call. You know, just staying with the internet for a second, what do you hope that the internet will tell us about who we are when we look at this archive? I mean, we have, you know, decades now, but we'll have more as time passes. What are you hoping it will tell us about who we are?
At least this period of the internet is this time when people are amazingly trusting. My parents, when I was going off to college, they repeated the advice they'd gotten from their parents, which is keep your head down. Careful what clubs you join, because that club might get you in trouble later from a McCarthy trial, right? And we have a trusting generation now going and posting their whole lives on the internet. They're going and what my sister put on a little diary and locked it with a key to keep me from reading it. I think that's what people are putting on their Facebook posts and making it available to anybody. So I think right now we've got a very trusting, diverse, participatory communities. I think we should deepen the conversation, though. I think our obsessions with Twitter or these little Facebook posts that aren't backed up by longer form thoughts, that if we can go and make it so that you can have things like on medium.com, the longer form discussions, that we should really be backing up what we're saying. So just having Wikipedia posts isn't enough. We need the debate. A lot of the materials from the 20th century, I was trying to understand the Dust Bowl. None of that's online. It's all way out of print. So going and finding that required going to a library or going and buying used books. We need to do better than that to deepen the conversation. So I think this generation is fantastic, and I hope we don't just really screw it up. And ways that Edward Snowden is showing we are screwing things up by going and betraying that trust, making it so that people will get in trouble for going and sharing. That's the worst tragedy we could have going forward.
Well, we have just 90 seconds left. What is it that you're really focused on right now in terms of archiving? I don't know. We talked a little bit about music and that being, but is there something that's a real focal area?
Oh, we're trying to make it so that there are lots of winners. It's right now there's this whole winner takes all trend, right? It's easier to have just one Gmail instead of a distributed email system. There's easier to have one Facebook than having everybody have blogs and share. So how can we make a distributed environment where there's lots of libraries that succeed, where we can make websites that are locked open? How can we go and live a distributed open world? That's what we're here for.
Well, Brewster Kahle, thank you so much for talking with us. I really
appreciate it.
Brewster Kahle, Internet pioneer, inventor, scientist, on a mission to preserve the internet, books, music, everything, and ensure that it's accessible to everyone. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauberg, Susan Britton, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from David Marks. Our engineer today is Howie Gelman. Our interns are Latoya Tools and Jeremy Siegel. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Thanks to Brewster Kahle. Thanks to our listeners for their great questions and insights. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.